We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
You don't want it. You don't need it. But you're going to get it anyway. The Kevin Sheehan Show. Here's Kevin.
So I am not too happy right now because the podcast should have been out earlier, but it isn't because I wasn't recording a significant segment of the show. I don't know how that happened, but whatever. We carry on and I'll do it again. It was, you know, probably a much too long opening segment anyway, leading into an interview with Ben Standing from Richmond on the football team. An interview with Mark Zuckerman on everything that happened with the Nats, and an interview with Chase Hughes from NBC Sports Washington on everything that happened with the Wizards. It was yesterday one of the craziest days. It was not your typical July 29th, that's for sure. In this business, July 29th is usually a make-it-up day. I mean, make it up, you know, try to come up with something that interests, you know, at least a few people. June and July are always the grinded out days in this business, as much as this business can be grinding it out. But, you know, in a town where football season is really the high season, June and July and August to a certain degree can be difficult. And you've got to be sort of creative. No creativity needed today. What a day yesterday was. You know, there's that saying about suspense in drama that it can be, you know, terrifying or frightening, but, you know, you hope it lasts, something like that. I forget how it goes. It's something like that. Boy, I hope yesterday can last because that was nuts yesterday, and it was great, and it was interesting, and the only thing missing from yesterday was, you know, an Adam Schefter breaking news, Washington and Houston are talking about a trade for Deshaun Watson. Can you imagine? I want to go through Nats and Wizards here quickly. I'll give you my quick thoughts because I'm going to shorten this opening segment from where it was before when I wasn't recording, and then we'll get to the interviews. I'm going to start with the Nationals, because the Nationals were in sell-off mode. And that really happened because of what happened last weekend. I believe, and I could be wrong, but I believe that if the Nats had gone into Baltimore and swept the Orioles, they may have had a different mindset this week. They would have been more focused on, we're going to get some players back, we're going to get healthy, we're still in the race here, it's a bad division. But losing to the American League's worst team in the Orioles was the breaking point. And if they were 50-50 on being a seller, it was at that point, you know, 100-0. That was a bad series, and you're not contending. And even though you're in a bad division, if you lose to Baltimore three straight times, you've got your answer. In most sell-offs, you know, you don't really know for a while who got the better of the deal. I think there are a lot of people that really follow farm systems and understand prospects and look at rankings. But you really don't know because these deals bring back prospects and prospects don't provide answers until they're not prospects anymore. The Nats, you know, did something yesterday that I think a lot of people were expecting, and then they did something that I don't think a lot of people were expecting. The sell-off of Scherzer, Hudson, Hand, and Schwarber was expected, and really it makes sense. Galdi was on with us the other day, and he mentioned that they've got the worst farm system in Major League Baseball, and they had to, you know, replenish that farm system. And if they weren't going to be contenders, they had to move on from some of these people and be a major seller. And they had assets that were attractive to contending teams. Scherzer, Hudson, Hand, Schwarber had contracts that were expiring. You can't lose those players to free agency when there's an opportunity to get something back for them in a season that is not producing a contending team. That was always the problem, right, with the football team. You know, the Kirk Cousins thing. As much as I loved Kirk and still do and think it was a big mistake the way they handled him, at the same time, I was a huge advocate and the first one screaming, trade him. Once they lowballed him for a second straight time and it became clear he didn't want to be here either, you had to trade him to San Francisco for the number two overall pick. But they didn't because they were petty and all of these other things. But I'm not going to get hung up on that. Sort of the same thing, you know, with Sheriff. Not enough foresight on Brandon Sheriff. You've got to, you know, move on from key assets that can bring back future assets when you know it's not going to work out. You've got to have that kind of vision and be aggressive. So kudos to Mike Rizzo for being a seller. It didn't make any sense not to be yesterday. However, you know, selling off players with expiring contracts and in some case veteran players like Max Scherzer, who are, you know, I guess past their prime, even though he's still great. You should be careful. You should be really careful about trading great players when you have them, even if that great player is going to cause a big decision a few years down the road about whether or not to pay him potentially hundreds of millions of dollars. So that's where we go now, and that is to Trey Turner. This was the one yesterday that many Nats fans had a problem with. The issue here is that Turner's a great player. He's not a good player. He's a great player. He's 28 years old. He's a top 10 to 15 player in baseball, a top 2 to 3 shortstop in the game. He was a part of a World Series team. He's a popular player among fans, but more importantly, he's a great player. And if you're even going to rebuild off of a sell-off, don't you want Soto and Turner and, you know, Corbin and maybe one or two others to be a part of that? Galdi told us the other day that Turner, you know, by the time he would sign that new big deal, would be entering his age 30 season. I think it was 30, Galdi said. And Galdi said, you know, that's a big risk. You know, he may be exiting his prime at that point. And I trust Galdi on baseball. That's his thing, man. He knows it. You know, and so I love, you know, listening to him talk baseball. I think it's more than that, though. And, you know, I had a conversation with somebody last night, and I think that it's more than just, you know, being really smart to deal Turner because you're not going to pay him because you think that actually at age 30, he is going to be on the downside of his career. I think it's the money more than the combo of the money and the risk of overpaying a great player whose best years may be behind him. I think the learners off a tough 18 months of COVID losses, which every MLB team suffered. Baseball is a sport in which live gate's important, and baseball took an absolute pounding due to COVID. But in the Nats' case, it was even more. They missed out on a huge financial windfall that would have come the year and really the years after winning their first World Series. And the learners, yes, they are wealthy. They are billionaires. They have the money. But that's not the way they run their businesses. They run their businesses as standalones, and each standalone has to pencil out down to the nickel. You know, their personal wealth doesn't play into their teams or their businesses' financial P&Ls. So we can argue as to whether or not they should have kept Turner and paid him. But if the answer was going to be no, for whatever the reasons were, and I do think that the COVID, you know, top line revenue hit, which was more major for Washington than any other team in baseball, if their answer was going to be no, we're not paying him, then they did the right thing by moving on from him. It hurts that this team won the World Series less than 2 years ago and now is a shell of itself. Scherzer, Turner, Hudson gone. Rendon was gone right from the jump. Strasburg's injury could be career-ending. But, you know, sports are funny, man. You know, they still are going to trot out and field a team, and that team's still going to have Juan Soto on it. And it's a terrible division. Watch them, you know, go on a big run here and get themselves back into it. But, you know, more likely than not, this is the beginning of a rebuild and a team that has really been a contender for, you know, going back to 2012, more likely than not, isn't going to be for a year or two, minimum. But much more on this with Mark Zuckerman coming up in about 20 minutes. The other big story, obviously, last night were your Washington Wizards in trading Russell Westbrook. Bravo, Tommy Shepard. I don't know that Tommy Shepard's ever going to figure everything out and you know, build a championship contender. That's really hard to do in the NBA, and it requires getting lucky because you have to end up with one of the top five players in the league to win a championship, and you know, at least a top 10 and another top 15-ish player to even contend in the NBA playoffs. This was going nowhere with Russell Westbrook, and I hate saying that because I've always been a big Russell Westbrook fan. But as a Russell Westbrook fan, I've learned something in recent years. You can't win with them. I don't think it's going to work in LA, by the way. When the game slows down in the postseason, he can't. If Bradley Beal's your best player and Russell Westbrook's your second best player, and I said this after the series against Philadelphia, you might win 45-46 regular season games and be entertaining as hell, but you're not going to win in the postseason. You probably won't win one series. You might win one. That's it. That's the upside. They're moving away from that. Now, are they going to move away from Beal? Most of the reporting says no, but I would have considered it. I've talked about this before. How you build a team around Beal right now is going to be very interesting. The players that they brought back, Kuzma, Harrell, and Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, I'm a big Montrezl Harrell fan. I love Harrell. I hated that he left the Clippers. Kuzma, you know, in L.A., overshadowed by LeBron and AD, and probably just couldn't figure out his role. Pope can really guard. They got the number 22 overall pick from the Lakers that they turned into Aaron Holiday from Indiana and another pick early in the second round. And they drafted Corey Kispert. Look, I'm a Corey Kispert fan. I like Corey Kispert. He's a great shooter. They've added some real shooters here yesterday. They added a lot of shooting, but they don't have a point guard. By the way, Kispert, competitor, tough, sharp shooter, can't really create his own offense. I think he's a better defender, but my last impression of Corey Kispert and almost everybody on that Gonzaga team is they were manhandled by Baylor. And you can talk about all you want, the UCLA semifinal game, and it drained Gonzaga. That was men versus boys. My favorite player, Davion Mitchell, picked early and before 15, as I predicted. Chris Duarte went two picks before the Wizards. That's who I wanted if he had been there at 15. Franz Wagner went much earlier. So the three players that I sort of talked about on yesterday's podcast were gone. I like Kispert, and I understand what they want to add. They want more shooters. They struggled with their shooters last year. But you've got to have a point guard. I don't know what's next. I think Beal stays and they try to build around him. And I think Tommy Shepard's going to have to do a really good job of convincing Beal that they can build around him. But the next step, and it's got to be the next step soon in free agency, right, or before, is a point guard, because for the first time, I don't know, in a decade, they don't have one. After Wall and Westbrook, they don't have a point guard. Aaron Holiday's not your starting point guard. He might have to be. Ish Smith and Neto aren't under contract. I'm a big Reggie Jackson fan. I think he's going to be too expensive. But we will get into this in much more detail with Chase Hughes. All right. Ben Standig, standing by from Richmond with the latest from camp this morning and even some stuff that happened yesterday. We'll get to that right after these words from a few of our sponsors.
Philip has just lost the respect of the youth league football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Mark Zuckerman coming up. We'll get more into the Nats day and night. Chase Hughes coming up. We'll get more into the Wizards situation with Chase. Ben Standing, nice enough to join us after the morning routine down in Richmond. There were some things that happened yesterday and some conversation today, and I just thought we would catch up with Ben through the first couple of days of training camp to talk about a couple of those things. I want to start with this. Yesterday, who ended up on COVID-19 protocol and ruled out for a while? There were a couple of players. Who were they?
So Cornelius Lucas was on there day one. Since then, Curtis Samuel, Matt Ioannidis added to the list, along with Chris Miller, who's like a deep training camp roster kind of a guy. So, you know, we don't have more specifics at the moment on to what degree they come in contact, did they test positive, what have you. But yeah, I mean, Samuel was already sidelined with a groin issue, we'll see about Ioannidis if it's a long term or not. But yeah. So they've got some more names to the list. And, obviously they were fortunate last year that they had zero games missed because of this. And, you know, we are in training camp. This is not the season. But, you know, I'm sure you've discussed a bunch that, their low vaccination rate and so on. And this is, an indication that this, could be a bit trickier for them at least entering the season than perhaps it was even a year ago when there was no vaccine.
After Ron Rivera's expression of frustration and disappointment earlier in the week, was there any concern for him yesterday?
For his health, you mean?
Yeah, his immune deficiency and being around some of these players that have tested positive.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect there was. So the way that's set up in Richmond, we've been on Zoom life, obviously, for all, the last, 15 months. But now in Richmond, we're back to some kind of face-to-face. We're in the same media room that we were in before, and the way it's working is, even though all the media is vaccinated, we don't have to wear a mask otherwise, when Rivera players come in, we all have to mask up, and they mask up. So they mask up or they don't, but in theory, the players, if they're unvaccinated, have to mask. Now Rivera will enter the room with a mask, and he kind of comes in every day and says to us, "Hey, is everybody here vaccinated?" Because he has said, "Hey, I am a little bit concerned." He also said he had some fatigue yesterday, because of the heat. It's pretty warm here. It was today, this afternoon. So I think there is some concern with his situation, as well as, the heat, combined sort of wearing him down. And does wearing him down, does that make him even a little bit more compromised? So yeah, it's definitely some level of concern, what's going on behind the scenes. I don't know, but, it's been mentioned that, if nothing else, this guy who had these problems, if you're not going to be vaccinated, okay, it's your choice. But for the record, the guy who's your coach, your leader, this may not be so good for him.
Mark Maskey reported earlier this morning that 87.9% of NFL players have now received at least one vaccine dose. Has there been any update as to Washington's numbers? Are they climbing, or are they? Do we have any update on their numbers?
The last I've seen came out from a couple of days ago. It was about 60%. I think the Washington Post had that.
Yeah,
I don't know if anything more specific than that. And it is certainly conceivable that some players, could be getting in process to getting the vaccine. It's been several months since I got it, but I remember, right? You get your first shot, then if you're getting the two shots kind, you get your shot. You have to wait like 3 or 4 weeks, then get the second one. Then after about 14 days, you're good. So yeah, it's conceivable that some guys either got it just when they got to camp, or they're still in that process. But we don't have hard numbers. All we can kind of see is there are players who at walkthrough, like during the regular practices, they're just in their usual helmets. But at the walkthrough, there's no helmets, and the guys who are not vaccinated essentially are being made to wear masks. That's a league policy. So, we'll see potentially over time. Well, actually, let me rephrase that. In Richmond, we're seeing the walkthroughs, the evening practice. In Ashburn, I don't believe we're going to have access to that. So we may not be able to see too much more face to face, as it were, on that front. But at least over the next, you know, couple of days, well, I guess there's only one more day left here. We'll maybe have a better sense of, if numbers have changed at all.
Last one on this, because I know people are probably tiring of this, but you guys are down there and you can put two and two together, and it sounds like there are some clues as to who's vaccinated and who isn't. And I suggested the other day on the podcast, you know, this 60% number is 60% of 90. So when they cut down to 53, that percentage could possibly go lower or it could go higher. Have any of you done sort of the back of the envelope math on whether or not the locks to make the roster are the significant percentage of the unvaccinated or the guys who aren't a lock to make the roster make up most of the unvaccinated?
Right. Yeah. So, you know, everything like you said, the back of the envelope math, and that's kind of what we're doing. You know, we're trying to take, you know, see what's out there, who's wearing a mask. There's a couple other clues. I'll keep to myself just as we're out there. But, you know, we're trying to get a sense of that. And I would say if I do sort of a rough guess of a 53-man roster, I mean, the number seems kind of, from a percentage basis, kind of seems in line with the overall number. So it is a fair amount of the players you would expect, to be on the roster are the ones wearing a mask. I mean, look, I don't want to, like, say names per se, but, like, for example, today, I mean, this is on TV or video, you know, we had Taylor Heinicke, Landon Collins, Brandon Scherff, all three entered the room wearing a mask. Now, again, they could be vaccinated and decide, hey, I just want to wear a mask no matter what. But, a certain amount of logic would believe that that's probably not the case. I think at least a couple of them were asked about it, and they didn't say that they were or that they weren't. They just said it's a personal choice and so on. So, yeah, I mean, it is definitely a decent amount of players who, you know, are going to be relied on for this team, or, you know, among the leaders. Again, doesn't mean none of them had a vaccine last year because there was none. So it doesn't mean that they can't avoid an issue. But at the moment, yeah, there are definitely two players who appear to be unvaccinated.
Yeah, and it's very possible that some of those players understand that even if they've been vaccinated, they could get it and then spread it to somebody that doesn't have it and somebody that's immune deficient like their head coach. Who knows? All right, let's get to football. Before we go backwards to yesterday, I know that Brandon Scherff spoke today, and you tweeted something out about something he said with respect to remaining a Washington football team player at the end of this year. What did he say?
Yeah, I asked him, you didn't sign an extension. You're playing on the tag again. For some players, that's a good thing. You want to be on a one-year deal, and others are maybe pissed off that you didn't get a longer-term deal. Where are you at with this? And he said he was comfortable with where he was. He reiterated that he wants to stay. Right now he's just going to focus on this season. And then I followed up with, okay, cool, but, like, it's now been multiple off seasons, and your two sides haven't been able to get a deal done. What gives you confidence that you're actually going to get one and there's probably not going to be a third tag? So why do you think you're actually going to be here long term? And he just said, look, I want to be here. I'm confident. He just reiterated that I'm confident that he wants to get it done. Actions speak louder than words. Brandon Scherff wasn't the only player to get a second tag this year. I believe almost all the other ones signed contracts. Justin Simmons in Denver is one that comes to mind, at least.
Right.
There wasn't any real sense that he was going to get something done. I mean, before they even gave him the tag, I had a column that said, don't do this. Figure out a long-term deal now. You'll know where you are or kind of look to move on. But, you know, look, it appears like they'll play this season. He's going to be their best offensive lineman, we would assume. And that's key. They need that, especially with some uncertainty at the tackle spots, especially the one right next to him. But at the same time, yeah, from a long-term perspective, I keep saying over and over again, I would be stunned at this point if Brandon Scherff is back here, because he's now going to have that $18 million salary as sort of the starting point for an annual average salary here. Maybe not somewhere else, but here. And that's just an awful lot to pay a guard. I mean, again, we'll see what happens this year. He was named all pro last year. Maybe he has a better year. Who knows? But, he's confident. I wouldn't say that I am, but presumably he knows more than I do.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of players in addition to Scherff. Isn't Allen Robinson playing on the franchise tag this year in Chicago? Because he wanted to get
dealt. He is. He is on the tag. Yeah, I mean, it's not completely uncommon. It's just, we've obviously seen it here once before. And, it's all relative. I mean, I guess one somebody kind of phrased to me, like, with one difference between Jonathan Allen's situation and Brandon Scherf's was that Jonathan Allen really pushed to stay here. And they would have been from that, not saying his side conceded anything, but, I think they really kind of, did that. Brandon Scherf says he wants to stay. I'm not doubting it, but it didn't have any sense from a negotiation standpoint that there was that same, hey, we got to get this done. I really want to stay.
Everybody healthy other than the COVID situations through the first couple of days, other than Curtis Samuel?
Yeah, Tim Settle was back. He had missed the first day or two with some sort of a non-football injury illness. Ricky Seals-Jones, one of the guys who, in theory, is in the mix for the third tight end spot, was out today with a lower leg issue. Rivera said it was relatively minor. Cam Sims, at one point today in practice, kind of was down on the ground for a bit and was having his left leg was checked, but Rivera said afterwards didn't look any, it was anything too serious. So, yeah, so far so good on that front. They haven't had any issues. And, just even getting Landon Collins back, to me is, such a win. I really did not comprehend that he'd be ready to go at the start of camp. Relatively speaking, he looked good.
You know how much I like you and how you are at the top of my list of people that I love to have these conversations with. But I'm going to pass on Steven Sims Jr. turning Jimmy Moreland around on a double move for a catch. And I'm going to pass on Terry McLaurin and William Jackson being a show day in and day out. And I'm going to focus on a couple of your other tweets, including something that I do think is always interesting, and that is, what are the coaches saying? What are the players saying? But Ron Rivera mentioned someone, and you tweeted out that player's name. He mentioned someone who is a great example of a veteran who seeks to help younger players. I want you to mention who that player is and whether or not you think that Rivera singling him out means anything.
Yeah, you're talking about John Bostic.
I am.
I'm not going to lie. At various points during these press conferences, I'll space out for 10 seconds because I'm thinking of a question, or maybe I'm pondering what happened at lunch. I went out for lunch. I don't know. But so I'm trying to think of the phrasing of that question, but how it came up. But in any event, yeah, I think it's sort of like a broad topic, and he cited Bostic, and that seems like an absolute straight example. I mean, Bostic, even for us in the locker room, he's been, when we had access to the locker room, he was a guy that we would all go to.
Yeah.
He wasn't the world's best quote, but he was a totally solid guy. He was seemed to be nice and helpful at all times and was willing to pitch in for us. I remember I did a story on Cole Holcomb a couple years ago when he was a rookie, and Bostic was the guy that I went to, and you could tell the rapport there. So, and look, obviously there's a first round pick on this team, and he plays the same position as John Bostic. And perhaps that's, top of Rivera's mind, because obviously Rivera's invested in Jamin Davis. So, I don't know if it means anything beyond that. I haven't, I know some people have had Bostic sort of as a borderline, potential surprise cut. I haven't gone there because I just don't know what I think of the depth behind the three starting linebackers. But, obviously any positive mention is a good thing.
I would be really surprised if Bostic got cut. He is a favorite of the coaches. He's high IQ. He's sort of Del Rio's coach on the field to a certain extent. I just think the intrigue comes with if Jamin Davis really proves ready to open the season at middle linebacker, where do you put Bostic on the field? He could play, Thomas Davis's position. He could play, strong side linebacker, I think, to start with Holcomb, at weak side. But I think that's one of those things we'll figure out as we watch, the first teamers in some of these preseason games to start. Taylor Heinicke spoke today. What did he say?
Yeah, it was sort of just a catch up with him. A lot of it was sort of, rehashing, the journey from, he's taking classes at ODU, sitting on his couch, to all of a sudden being in this playoff game with Tom Brady, but just how he's learned to think about it, embrace it. He said he's gone back and watched the Tampa Bay game a couple times because he was proud of what he did, and he wanted to sort of embrace that opportunity. But simultaneously, I asked him, you become a very popular player here based on five quarters of football. And it's and at least, you know, you've played a little bit more than that, but ultimately, in terms of being here, it's five quarters. Right. Having, you know, I imagine that it makes kind of evaluating what you are a bit of a challenge, and therefore I imagine you kind of probably feel something to prove. And he said he's aware that he's gotten more attention. He's also aware that the two games he has started in the NFL, he got hurt in both, and his team lost both games. And, you know, so he can get some attention, but ultimately you're going to have to stay on the field and win. So that's a step for him. But, you know, it is still kind of a ridiculously crazy story. While I think you and I don't believe that there's an actual quarterback competition, he is the other name consistently mentioned as being part of that, a guy who, you know, a year ago he said, you know, he was pretty close to hanging it up. I think he said he had made himself a deal, like if he went two full years since his last game, he was going to hang it up. And he said he was about 5 or 6 weeks away from that happening, I guess basically the end of the season. And you know, he says he probably would have hung it up at that point, but obviously Washington called and, you know, rewrote his history, or rewrote his future.
He got some first-team reps yesterday, and what about today?
You know, I don't know. The first-team reps thing is sort of tricky. Fitzpatrick is going first in all the drills, and then, like, they're mixing and matching a lot. So the first-team reps, it's not like he was out there with every single offensive starter, but you kind of look to see Taylor Heineke's on the field, and so is, like, Chase Young, right? Something like that. Like, okay, he's going up against the actual, you know, some of the starters on defense. So, you know, I don't think any of the quarterbacks to me have stood out to such a degree that you're like, wow, look at that. It's, you know, it's make some plays here, miss some throws there. It's obviously, you know, it's still very early. It's only day 3 of camp. There's no pads. You know, I've got to qualify 27 things. But, you know, I mean, you can see at times, you know, some of those moxie plays that he makes, which makes him such an interesting player. There was one play today where it was sort of like some type of fake handoff, and he kind of, you know, turns it up the field, and, you know, you're like, ooh, you know, look at that element. And, you know, it's you know, he's a fun player, but you know, it's good, and we'll see where this goes. And again, Kyle Allen, I know you said you talked about it the other day when you talked to Rivera, and it was a topic that came up yesterday that, you know, Rivera says Kyle Allen is, you know, conceivably still going to be in the mix. You know, I don't know how you have three guys compete, or if I believe it, or it doesn't yet matter because it's going to be Fitzpatrick. But, you know, it's going to be a fun watch all summer.
Yeah, one of the things that Rivera said today, right, is just how much his teammates sort of believe in him, and he's got a lot of fans among his teammates.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, look, we've, you know, anybody who's played competitive sports, you don't have had to have been a professional athlete to know that there are some players, some people you play games with that you like playing with more, that inspire something out of you, because they just have a certain element to what they do. And Heineke, there is something there. I don't think that's really much for debate. His biggest issue has been, can he stay on the field? You know, he doesn't have the world's strongest arm, and he gets hurt, you know, based on his career, every game he starts. But yeah, there is this intangible quality to him that you can't just teach. And, you know, I think like Kyle Allen feels like a bit more traditional sort of pocket passer who's a little stiff, could maybe make some throws. And I'm not discounting Kyle Allen, I'm just saying, but he doesn't have that thing, that quality that Heineke has. That doesn't mean he should be the starter, but there is something there that I totally get why Chase Young or others might be like, ooh, I kind of like this guy.
All right, a couple more, and then I'll let you run because I know you got to get back to it. Has there been, and, you know, I don't know how much stock you put into this, and I don't know necessarily that I put much stock into it on July 30th, you know, day 3 of camp, but has there been any, you know, in the 11-on-11 first team versus second team kind of reps in terms of players being in a spot, you know, with a group that was unexpected?
Not a ton. I mean, you know, there's a couple moments here and there where you take note of,
I
think I saw today, like Cole Luke today, a guy we don't even talk about making the team. I think at one point today he was out there as one of the 5 defensive backs. I think he was out there with some of the starters, and, you know, they've mixed and matched. mixed and matched some of the receivers at times. But I think by and large, it's been fairly conventional in terms of the starting lineup. I will say that, like, you know, you're very dismissive of the Steven Sims tweet, which is a tremendous tweet. But the point for me was the punt returner situation is super fascinating, because the four guys who have been back there whenever they've been doing this are like Steven Sims, Dax Milne, Isaiah Wright, and DeAndre Carter, and I don't have any of those guys on my basic 53-man roster. And the reason why Steven Sims is interesting, I thought, is obviously he has played before. He has started as a receiver. And I would, you know, he was the punt returner last year. Now, I don't think he was particularly good at that job, but he was that guy. And I think he's looked pretty decent in camp. He did make that nice move today. And I did ask him, Rivera, about him specifically today. And, you know, Ron said some, you know, nice things about him and so on. But, like, I do feel like Steven Sims has done some good things, as have guys like Kelvin Harmon, and some others. So it's a really deep group. But if Sims shows out enough a receiver, I mean, and he's viewed as the main punt returner, then I think he makes the team. And then the question is, are you keeping seven receivers or only six? So I think Steven Sims has been. I'm not saying he's going to challenge McLaurin or Samuel or some of those guys at the top for snaps. But at the same point, you know, if he can keep this going, you know, maybe he actually does make the team, especially as the punt returner.
Well, look, I mean, they kept him in there last year, despite the fact that it seemed at one point it was even money he was going to muff or outright fumble a punt return that cost him dearly in a game that they needed to have against Carolina. The fact that they kept putting him back out there obviously means that they believe in him and they believe in something about him. So I guess on one hand, that shouldn't be that surprising, that they loved him enough that where they didn't pull him from that position last year when they probably should have. They brought him back, so they like something about him as a punt returner. And, you know, they haven't gotten much from their return game in recent years. And it's a big part of, you know, the game still. Not kickoff returns, but punt returns and guys that can really, you know, flip the field. And they haven't had anybody like that in recent years. So that is interesting to watch. And I'm trying to think, you know, for whatever reason, when you just mentioned Cole Luke, I know he got snaps last year. I remember him being on the field last year, you know, a couple of times and being noticeable. And what I can't remember is, did he return punts in any of those games? Or am I thinking of somebody else?
Danny Johnson was the one who was their primary returner.
Stroman's done it.
Yeah, Stroman's still out. So Danny Johnson hasn't been, you know, he was more of a kick returner last year. He has not been back there on punts. He didn't even play corner last year, his natural position of corner. He only did special teams. So conceivably he could be that guy, but again, they're not using him at the moment as a punt returner. And I will just sort of lastly say, like Rivera said today, like what he's seeing from Steven Sims is what you want to see as a slot receiver. I think a big question for me has been, and is, where are they actually going to use Curtis Samuel? If Curtis Samuel, like Carolina did last year, the post-Rivera coaching staff, they used him primarily in the slot, and he was very effective.
And in the backfield. And in the backfield.
But the Rivera-Scott Turner group in Carolina used him more outside. And so if they go with the slot, which I don't know if they will. I thought they might, but I don't know. Then it seems like, you know, and Adam Humphreys, you know, won't get as much work, and maybe a Steven Sims can slide in if he's a returner. On the other hand, if Samuel's outside, then you kind of need two guys in the slot, right? And Humphreys and Sims could fill those roles. So I feel like it's going to be hard to, I think, figure out exactly what they want to do at receiver until Samuel gets on the field, because he's the guy that's going to be all over the place, I would think.
I'll tell you what. Think about last year. They used McLaurin in the slot at times when they had five wides. You had McKissick split out as either the X or the Z occasionally in their empty sets with McLaurin, you know, matched up. This is where I think some of us, many who are listening, I think some of you missed that Scott Turner schemed it up pretty well at times last year. I think he really did. So I guess we're not going to know. They're certainly not going to show that in any preseason game. You'll probably see a little bit more of maybe how they're going to use Curtis Samuel when he's back versus Humphreys versus Sims Jr. I mean, Sims Jr. and Humphreys are clear slot guys only, but it doesn't mean that others aren't going to be in that position. And Curtis Samuel literally lined up in the backfield last year. Remember, he was a running back at Ohio State, so he lined up in the backfield, especially when McCaffrey was out, and had a significant number of carries, and they weren't all, you know, fly sweeps or reverses. What else? Anything that I didn't ask you that is significant?
I probably have lost some good weight, water weight, because it's so hot, but simultaneously I'm eating crap food the whole time.
Yeah,
so
you went through some drive-through. Which drive-through did you just go through?
Yeah, it was a Chick-fil-A. It was on the way back to my hotel. Yeah. You know, I'm gonna have to make that move. They're very efficient. Tons of cars in line, but I got out pretty quick. But in terms of the football stuff, I mean, I don't know. I guess I will just say that today was the first day we had some tempers flaring. Mark Hemingway was getting into it with Montez Sweat, and Chase Young was chirping in, and Hemingway came off, had to sort of be held back a bit, came off the field, slammed his helmet to the ground, and then a few minutes later, Samus Reyes and Cole Holcomb got into it, and it's the thing that's going to happen at some point. It kind of makes you be like, all right, training camp, we're going, let's go. Rivera was asked about it, and he's like, look, I tell these guys all the time, fighting is stupid. You're either going to get hurt, get a penalty, or just lose focus on what you're doing, because now you're thinking about getting retaliation, and that's not good for anybody. That said, it's training camp. It's okay to see a little temper flare, get these guys going. That was fun to see. Nothing big happened beyond that, but you know, it's a sign of perhaps of what's to come, especially while we're here in Richmond, because it is crazy hot, and obviously these guys are, you know, they're getting after it.
Nothing like driving down Broad Street right after, you know, the morning practice, looking for something to eat and finding Chick-fil-A. That's always a better call than some of the other stuff you could have gone with. Thank you for doing this. I appreciate it. Have a good weekend. I would talk to you about the Wizards, and I know you were following it. I know you've got really good thoughts about it, but I'm going to save that for Chase, even though you and I in previous years would have spent more time on that. Thank you and enjoy. Are you coming back next week? I guess everybody's coming back next week.
Yeah, Saturday. There's a Saturday morning practice, and that's kind of it. And then I'm going to just drive straight to Los Angeles because I can't wait to watch Russell Westbrook and LeBron get in each other's way during the playoffs.
Okay, you know what? Okay, so that's what I'm going to talk to you about, because I've already recorded the interview with Chase, and I did not ask him about this. I'm going to give you my opinion on this as from a Lakers perspective. I do not think it will work for the Lakers.
No chance. I'll go so far as to say this.
So you agree with me?
If you are watching, I don't know who said what, because I wasn't really watching TV last night because I was dealing with this team and doing some other stuff. Uh-huh. But I was tracking the draft on the draft and slightly paying attention with TV. Whoever is saying that this will work, you should stop listening to them as an analyst. This will not work at all. LeBron is, you know, an incredible player but he needs the ball. So you need people around him who can shoot. Russell Westbrook is an incredible player who needs the ball but can't shoot. So it doesn't matter what happens in Game 10 against the Nuggets or Game 46 against the Timberwolves. I'm talking Game 4, Game 5, Game 6, Game 7 of a playoff series in the fourth quarter. Their offense will be a disaster. I have no confidence this will work on any level. And by the way, like somebody said to me the other day, like, well, it works with LeBron and Wade can't shoot. Wade is a much savvier player who will blend in. Westbrook does what Westbrook does, which is why, regardless of anything else, it was good for the Wizards because Wes Unseld can now coach this team as he would, not have this obstacle, who's a very good player, but he's going to do what he wants. So it'll be amazing to see how Westbrook and LeBron, how they can gel or not. I don't see it working at all. And these two guys are so alphas. I just think it's going to be amazing.
It's Westbrook makes every team he goes to interesting, but he does not make them a playoff championship contender. Now, I know that he went to the championship with Oklahoma City and lost to Miami in four games. And by the way, for several of those games in that series was even more the alpha than Kevin Durant was. I am a big Russell Westbrook fan. I always have been. And I enjoyed last year during the regular season. But I've come to the conclusion, and I think you have too, that it's just, it doesn't work when the games slow down and they become important possession by possession for not just the fourth quarter, but for every quarter. And I don't see this working out for that reason, let alone the ones you added to it, which is LeBron has to have the ball in his hands. Westbrook needs to have it in his hands. Westbrook is going to be... I think very much what it looked like at times with Harden for the brief moment that we saw that, uncomfortable. Now, the big difference is James and Davis by themselves make the Lakers, if they're healthy, a contender. Now, will Westbrook, you know, ruin that possibility, minimize that possibility? I think there's a chance that he does. I think, and again, it's like every time I say that, so many people, Ben, that are listening are like, dude, you were the biggest Russell Westbrook fan, and I still am. Nobody in team sports over the last 10 years has tried harder than Russ. He is one of the all-time most intense, relentless, high-energy competitors in team sports history, and he gets phenomenal results in the regular season, and if your team can get stops and take the ball off the rim and get out and transition, he's devastating. But we saw what it was like in the postseason here. And other teams have seen what it's been like in the postseason with him. When the game slows down, he can't. And I'm surprised, to be perfectly honest with you, that this is what LeBron wanted. I think I can't believe that it's to the Lakers. I think I'm really surprised LeBron, who, whatever you think of him, is a high, high IQ basketball person. I'm shocked that he thinks this will work, because obviously it was his call.
So I would just say this to that. Obviously everybody is their own individual, but having talked to enough athletes over the years, and maybe it's because they've all been beaten into the next man up mentality, but I think by and large, at least what they say publicly and sometimes privately, they all seem to think that they can make whatever work with whatever. They just want talent. They don't recognize always the fit. Like when Aaron Rodgers talked the other day, which was in the most amazing press conference ever, and he talked, and it was a great question about why do you want to be involved in these decisions when all the decisions you seem to want to have made floundered on the player went somewhere else and didn't work. He's like, yeah, it didn't work there. They would be playing here with me doing this. And that's the thing with fit. Yeah. That fit sometimes... it isn't about just talent. This is why I like Team USA. You shouldn't take 12 all-star players. You need to take 8 guys who are great and then fill in the blanks of guys who will do specific things if you're actually trying to win and not just have the best marketing campaign you can have. So Westbrook, yeah, on paper, the Lakers may have 3 of the best 25 players in the game. But the fit is terrible. The fit with Buddy Hield, whatever, as a name was being mentioned, seemingly to me is much better because Buddy Hield can shoot. LeBron gets double teamed. He passes the ball to the open shooter. Boom. This is the basic. This is how this works. So, yeah, I mean, my sense is LeBron is just desperate. He's only viewing the finish line as getting close for him. He's got, who knows how many more shots to win. And conceivably, Westbrook was the best pure individual talent they could get. And he said, yeah, let's do it. I'm sure he would rather have had Chris Paul, but that wasn't a thing. So, he's going for the talent over the fit, and he probably thinks, I'm LeBron James, damn it. Look what else I've done. I can do anything. I'll make this work. We'll see.
And we will see what the Wizards do next, because there's got to be a next, and I'm going to catch up with Chase Hughes a little bit later on after Mark Zuckerman, who's going to join us next to talk about that. Thank you. Always good to catch up. Have a good weekend. Have a good trip home, and I will talk to you next week.
Yeah, by the way, 50% off The Athletic right now. Go click on one of my articles and then go through that way, and then everybody will be happy, including me, despite this heat. Okay, that's
it. No. Hold on. I want everybody to make sure that they heard that, and I'm being serious. I've obviously pushed The Athletic when Ben's on and when other people from The Athletic are on. I also am associated and affiliated with The Athletic from a business standpoint. I've mentioned that on the show before. But I'm also a customer of The Athletic. But I want to make sure that those of you that are interested in subscribing to The Athletic hear what Ben just said. Right now, 50% off It's totally worth it. But the way that I would ask that you do it is to go to one of Ben's articles, which you would have to subscribe by clicking on his article that you want to read more of Ben's article, and subscribe via that route. That way they know that you were there to read Ben, and that's why you subscribed to The Athletic. But really, in all honesty, I know I pitch a lot of different stuff on this podcast, but I was skeptical at the very beginning. It has totally been worth it for Ben, number one, but for a lot of other people. Like, David Aldridge has written so well this week on everything NBA and Wizards related. You've got that, and Tariq El-Bashir is phenomenal on the Caps, and they've got a really good group. And then you can read the writers from every other city and the national writers as well. To be honest with you, I think it's a better one-stop shop solution than any of the major websites, you know, ESPN, CBSSportsLine.com, etc. I really do. All right. Have at it. Good weekend. Talk next week. Ben Standing, everybody. Up next, we will talk with Mark Zuckerman from Masson Sports and the Nats Chat podcast about everything that went down with the Nats yesterday.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Subscribe to the podcast. If you haven't done that, doesn't cost you a thing. Also, rate us and review us where you can, especially on Apple and Spotify. Mark Zuckerman covers the team, of course, for MassonSports.com. Follow him on Twitter at Mark Zuckerman. Also, the Nats Chat podcast that he does with Galdi and Tim Shovers is a must listen to. You get it anywhere you get a podcast. You're going to want to listen to that podcast today for sure. Mark joins us right now. I want to save the Trey Turner portion of this conversation for a second, because I think that that was the part of the day yesterday that may not have been a shocker for everybody, but it was disappointing to many. And I want to talk about that in great detail. But before we get to that, overall, the parts that we thought would, you know, had the potential to get sold off did, you know, Max, Hand, Hudson, Schwarber. How did they do? How did Mike Rizzo do in what he pulled back? And I understand that part of the pullback from the Dodgers was because of Turner. But overall, you know, the parts that they sold off and what they got back, what kind of day was it? I know it's hard at this point with prospects, but what did you make of the haul they got back?
You know, honestly, Kevin, it's too hard to even really know that right now. I'm not going to claim to be a huge prospect guru. I can just tell you what people around the industry are saying and what they think about this. And that is, it's really hard nowadays to get a lot for rental players. This used to be a thing, 10, 20 years ago, where you could trade a pending free agent and get two or three elite prospects for them. And teams have just become smarter at this. They understand the value of elite prospects. They understand that a rental player for 2 months, it might help carry you over the top, but often it's not worth as much as they used to give up for it. So, the two they got from the Dodgers, and we'll get to that, are the big names. And the rest of them are players that they hope some of them pan out and become good big leaguers for them. But I don't think there's anyone in that group that you say, oh, yes, this is the one to really be excited about. And maybe they pan out, maybe they don't. It's such a crapshoot in this world when it comes to young baseball players and prospects and all that. But here's the thing. You put all of that in totality. And to me, it's like you don't just evaluate one of these trades. You evaluate the entire thing. And what they have done yesterday and they're going to continue to do before today is over is you trade all of your valuable assets here and stockpile as many good quality young players as you can. And from that quantity, you hope to get some quality out of it. You hope you get a couple of future stars. You hope you get a couple of future good, solid big leaguers. And then you just hope to fill out the rest of your minor league system because that is the state of the organization. They've been in such bad shape there for a while now. It hasn't shown at the big league level because they've been winning for a long time. But eventually you have to have another group of kids to come up and replace them all. And they went into this season with the lowest rated farm system in baseball. And we've seen this year how that's been exposed. They did not have the depth to overcome their injuries, other calamities that have happened to them. So this is the first step towards rectifying that. And you just hope that several of these players that they're getting here in the last 24 hours are ultimately going to be part of the next team that wins here.
Did they do the right thing in trading Trey Turner?
I believe they did, and it's hard. And 72 hours ago, I would have said, no way, don't do that. But here's what's happened in the last – it's built up over the last month, but really in the last week, this is what's happened. They lost some games to some bad teams in horrible fashion that ruined any chance they had of making a run this year. I thought there was still a chance. The schedule was easing up, and they were going to start getting healthier. And then they got swept by the Orioles, and it was ugly. And they lost the first game to the Phillies on another blown save by Brad Hand. And it just got to the point you said, okay, this is not going to happen this year. This team's not going to be able to pull it off. And then, and I think this is really the key development that shaped a lot of what they've done, is the Steven Strasburg news. Okay, a week ago, they thought he was coming back this year. They thought he was a couple weeks away from pitching for them this year. And then he continued to have the issue in his neck. They sent him down to Dallas to see a specialist. And he was diagnosed with thoracic outlet syndrome, which for a major league pitcher, these days, that is the worst injury you can be told you have. That's worse than Tommy John surgery, labrum, rotator cuff, any of that stuff. This is the worst one. He had the surgery for it. They believe he'll be back at some point next year. And history says that most pitchers do come back and pitch again in the big leagues. But it also says that most of them do not come back to be the same kind of pitcher they were. And that, to me, was the sort of the final straw that Mike Rizzo and Mark Lerner looked at this and said, we're not just not in a position to win this year, but we're probably not in a good position to win next year either. And that's why you move Trey Turner. If you were going for it in 2022, you keep Turner around. But once they realize it's not going to happen next year, it's time to actually start this whole thing over again, you have to trade your best commodity to get something more than just one of those second-tier prospects I was talking about before. You don't get a lot for rental players, but for a star player who has 1 year plus the 2 months the rest of this year, you can actually get something. And so that's why the Scherzer and Turner trade netted them the Dodgers' top two prospects, two top 50 prospects in baseball. These days, that's as good as you're going to get in a trade. It's hard to do better than that. Who knows if they pan out? They may not. But for what they were working with, I think that was the best they could have done.
But on Turner, I get it. You know, if you aren't going to win, and let's just assume that part of the conversation was, we're not winning this year, we're not winning next year, and then we've got to pay him, right? We've got to pay him. But he's a great player. He's not a good player. He's a great player. He's a top 15 player. He's a top 2 to 3 shortstop in the game. If you're planning on winning in 2023 and 2024, why not consider paying him?
It's a good question, and it's not necessarily wrong to think in those terms. And I believed for a while that there was a good chance that he might be the one who would stay out of all this group of big-time position players who have left. But I think it's a couple things. As great as he is right now, and he absolutely is, are we sure that as he gets into his 30s, he's still going to be that player as a shortstop? I don't know the answer to that. Maybe he will be,
But you think about what his skills are, and speed is such a big part of it. Is that sustainable deep into his career? And the market for shortstops has just skyrocketed here lately. Francisco Lindor got $300 million. You compare Lindor and Turner, and Trey's better than him. So are you ready to commit $300 million to Trey Turner to pay him that much while he's in his 30s? He's going to turn 30 in his first year of the next deal in 2023. So there's risk there. And to go back to Strasburg again, if you're Mark Lerner and you now see you're saddled with $245 million to Strasburg, and he may never be the same pitcher again, I bet you're a little gun-shy about giving a deal like that to anybody, certainly somebody who's entering his 30s at that point. So I get it, and it wouldn't necessarily be a totally wrong decision to think you could re-sign Trey Turner long-term, but there's risk involved in that as well. And I just wondered, given everything else that's happened and the shape of the market and all this, if they looked at that and said, we love you as a player, Trey, but we're not convinced that that would be a wise move for us to give you that much money.
So it's just interesting the way, as you said, I mean, even in the last week, the Strasburg trade and all of these injuries, you know, if Schwarber doesn't get hurt, if Hudson doesn't get hurt, even if Strasburg's done for the year, if they've got, everybody else and they don't get swept by the Orioles and they, win a couple of more against the Padres and the Dodgers and they're five back or five and a half back or four and a half back instead of seven and a half or eight back. None of this probably happened yesterday. Maybe some of it does, but Turner certainly doesn't get dealt.
No, and I think they even are buyers today, if that was the case. That's how, on a razor's edge they were. It could have gone either way. And when Rizzo spoke to us last week, he talked about this sort of dual path that they were looking at. I think he truly believed that he was going on the buy path. He did not think that everything that's happened in the last week was going to happen to leave them in this position where they had no choice to sell, in his mind. I absolutely think they beat the Orioles, they closed out the games they needed to, that Strasburg doesn't have that injury, and they look at it and say, hey, we're gaining on the Mets. The Mets aren't that great. They've got issues. The rest of the division is very weak. We may not be a truly championship team this year, and our odds of beating the Dodgers or the Giants or the Padres in the playoffs is maybe not great, but hey, we got a chance to win the division. So with this group, let's go for it. Let's give it one more shot here before all these guys become free agents. So I absolutely think that was his mindset. And then everything that happened from that day forward was nothing but calamity. And it got to the point by Thursday that you just said, there's no rational answer to this now except to sell. And if you're going to sell, you got to be all in on it. You can't just sell a couple of spare parts and think that that's going to make a difference long term for you. If you're going to do this, you got to be all the way with it. And that's what they've done.
I think there was something else at work here, and I've talked about it earlier in this podcast, and I want your thoughts on it. COVID devastated, all of sports from a revenue standpoint, really hurt baseball from a top-line revenue standpoint. But beyond that, the Nats were hurt more than anybody else because there is this expected and typical windfall of top-line revenue that is generated off of a World Series that they never got to experience. And I think, Mark, that had we not had COVID over the last 18 months, that the Lerners, who, by the way, pencil everything out, we all understand that they are billionaires and they could write any check that they want to check. That's not how they run their businesses, though. These businesses, from a P&L standpoint, have to pencil out. And I just wonder if there wasn't COVID and the big hit that everybody took, but the Nats probably took more than anybody else because they didn't get that huge bounce from winning the World Series. I wonder if they would have just said, no, we're going to pay Trey Turner. We're going to keep one of the best two or three shortstops in the game.
I think that's absolutely fair. I think, you can trace all this back. To me, it all goes back to, and Tim Shover is our friend who produces our podcast, NASChat, came up with this. He said, it all goes back to literally the night of the parade at the end of 2019. The parade is like a glorious day for everyone, and then that night, Stevie Strasburg opts out of his contract, which was his right to do, and that was the deadline for it. But from that moment forward, everything that happened has led to this moment where everything that went wrong. And COVID was a huge part of that because you're right. They lost the victory lap. And not just a symbolic thing, but a practical thing. You look at teams that win a championship, especially their first championship. What happens the year after season ticket sales go way up. TV ratings go way up. There's so much more attention on the franchise and good vibes. And yet, teams can live off that for years. And the Nats were denied that, absolutely. And COVID is the reason for it. And, you know, you can say, yeah, that was out of their control, absolutely. But you can also say, okay, there were things they still could have done to try to have a better roster this year, to be in a better position to try to win this year, and it didn't happen, some in their control, some out of their control, and now look where they are. But yeah, I you can absolutely trace it back to COVID and say that that had a devastating effect on the franchise, not just in the short term, but in the long term as well.
The Nats Chat podcast with Galdi and Mark and Tim Shovers is phenomenal, and it's a must listen to today. So after you listen to this podcast, get to the Nats Chat podcast that they put out. And, you know, this is going to be an interesting couple of years because literally it hasn't even been 2 years since a World Series title, and now you've got a few players only left on the team, and it's a team that, look, it's in a bad division, and you never know, right? I mean, they're going to still field a team, and that team's still going to include Juan Soto, who, by the way, is crushing it right now. And, you know, that was a devastating, you know, blown 7-0 lead yesterday in the second of two with the Phillies. But really, practically speaking, the odds are we are probably 2 to 3 years away from talking about this team in the same way we've been talking about them since 2012.
I think so, probably. You know, let's see where they go. I mean, I suppose it's possible that Mike Rizzo is going to tell us that now that they've shed all that money and moved on from all those guys, that this winter they're not going to rebuild, they're going to reload. And they're going to go sign some big free agents this winter and try to win right away and then hope that next wave helps out at some point. I don't think that's where they're going with this. I mean, again, you don't trade Trey Turner if that's what you're thinking. And if you have doubts about Steven Strasburg pitching for you next year, I don't think you're thinking you're trying to win in 2022. But we'll see. We'll see. But, no, I agree. And it's been a long time since they've been in this position. 2010, 2011 is the last time. And let's remind ourselves that what they did for basically a decade as a contender. I know they didn't make the playoffs every year, but they were trying to every year there. They made the playoffs 5 times. They won the division 4 times. They won the World Series. That is a really, really good run. And up until last year when they finally had a losing record in the short season, it was Nats, Yankees, Dodgers, and Cardinals.
Right.
Were the only 4 teams that had winning records every one of those years. So, I mean, they deserve to be in that elite class. But for everyone, it does have to end eventually. I know you can say, well, the Dodgers don't happen to them, the Yankees doesn't happen to them. Well, if you want to spend like the Dodgers and Yankees, then go for it. But you know what those two organizations also have that's allowed them to sustain it? Great farm systems. And the Nats have not had that in several years now. And that's why they're in the position they're in now.
All right, last question. You know, let's just assume here that they're not able to, you know, rebuild a lesser expensive contender for the next couple of years. I know that the Lerners have paid. We know that. They have paid big for players before, and then they've passed on others. You don't think that they, you know, without a contending team, that they would move in a different direction when it's time to pay Juan Soto, do you?
Well, here's what I would say. I think, my opinion, and I think it's the opinion of a lot of people inside and outside the organization, is that if there is one guy over the last several years, not just this current group, but the last several years, that you would say, yes, he is worth whatever it costs to keep him, it's Juan Soto. He's a generational talent. He is still so young. He's going to be a free agent at, 26, I think it is. With skills that could not deteriorate.
25, I think, at 26 years old, yeah.
So that, to me, there's far less risk in signing him to a mega contract than there is Trey Turner, Steven Strasburg, Anthony Rendon, take your pick. So I think they go full-court press on him, but that doesn't mean it's going to happen because Juan Soto and Scott Boras, his agent, almost always take it all the way to free agency. and which is their right to do that. And in a lot of ways, it makes a lot of sense to do that, not to take the first big contract offer you're given now before you have a chance to negotiate with other teams. And we'll see what happens at that point. But to me, the next step, and it may not happen right now, it's several years away, but the next step for the Learners, now that you've done this, it's got to be all about keeping Juan Soto. And the best way to do that, in addition to the money, is to make sure that by the time he becomes, that it is his last year here, in theory, in 2024, that you have a winning team again. So that helps convince him that you are on the right track and that now he can be the leader of the next team that competes for a championship in town.
You know, you wrote in your among many stories over the last 24 hours that, you know, essentially a champion's been broken up here. And it started really with Rendon leaving, obviously. But less than 2 years after a title, you know, that championship roster has been broken up. And as you wrote, they've now got the task of trying to build another. We'll see how they do with it. Nats Chat Podcast. For Mark, he's with Galdi on it. It's an absolute listen for Nats fans. Of course, follow Mark on Twitter at Mark Zuckerman and read him at massinsports.com. I know it was a crazy day, so I appreciate you making time for me today. I'll talk to you soon.
All right, my pleasure, Kevin.
Up next, Chase Hughes from NBC Sports Washington. We'll get to the Wizards in more detail right after these words from a few of our sponsors. Let's bring in Chase Hughes from NBC Sports Washington. Chase does a great job covering the Wizards and the NBA for NBC Sports Washington. You can follow him on Twitter at Chase Hughes NBCS. Before we get to the trade and everything they got back and the draft and what's next, I just want to ask you, because I personally was surprised when I saw the breaking news and my phone start lighting up late yesterday afternoon, early evening, about Westbrook being traded. Were you surprised?
I was a little bit surprised. You know, it's interesting. Rumors had kind of surfaced, but it wasn't anything concrete, just about maybe Russell Westbrook would go to the Lakers. There were these, like, small signs I'd been asked about by fans where it's like, hey, well, hey, you know, LeBron and Anthony Davis are starting to follow Russell Westbrook's wife and people who are close to him on Instagram. And I guess technically, there were some signs there, some very 2021 signs, but certainly nothing substantial in the way of a rumor that would say, okay, this is imminent. Nothing like last year when, you know, the rumor, of course, broke that John Wall might be going to the Rockets in a trade for Russell Westbrook. We kind of marinated on that one for like a week. This one, I guess, bubbled up a little bit, but then sort of came out of nowhere, I would say.
So before we get to the trade itself and then to the draft choices and the other trade they made, what do you think, Chase, this says about the direction the franchise wants to take?
You know, that's a fascinating question because I keep looking at this roster and I'm not quite sure yet, because looking at this roster right now, the first thing that stands out to me is it's one Bradley Beal trade away from a rebuild. Like, they created flexibility, but ultimately what they did is they had two stars, and now they have one and a bunch of pieces around them. And they've got some good players and some depth, and, you know, if they want to move forward with Bradley Beal and just a deep roster around him, maybe they can fill in the gaps. Of course, they need a point guard, and maybe they could be a playoff team. But right now, it seems like they may have taken a step back with the possibility of taking two steps forward. But I just don't know what that move would be, because ultimately, in this day and age, and just in the NBA, you're not going to win much of anything with one star, especially if that star is a third-team All-NBA guy. So are they going to push the gas, and is there some other big deal that we're not seeing yet? Or is this the beginning of a rebuild? I think it's difficult to tell. I think this is the team that's in transition as they enter free agency.
You know, the step back for two steps forward is a good description. I mean, it's a step back from something that was never going to work. You would agree with that, right?
As constituted No, but I think the other way they could have gone is maybe to try to make a big trade to add to what they had, but as constituted, no, I would agree.
Yeah, I mean, and what would that big trade have been? Because to me, the big trade would have had to bring back the best of the three players, or certainly the second best of the three players. I just don't – I'm not a believer, and I'm curious as to what you think. I'm not a believer that Bradley Beal as your best player is a championship-caliber team, even if there are another one to two stars as part of it.
No, I mean, I agree. I think they would have had to bring someone back who at a minimum was as good as Bradley Beal. Obviously, it'd be very difficult to bring back someone who's better. But yeah, you wouldn't be looking for someone who's not as good as Russell Westbrook or not as valuable as Russell Westbrook. But you know, that's kind of the way contenders are built these days. I mean, look at the Lakers. They literally, I think, only have four players on their roster right now. They gave everything to get Russell Westbrook just because it was a third star, and they will kind of figure out the rest later. So I thought maybe they could try to do that. Maybe they have evaluated the possibility of doing that and thought it wasn't realistic, and now have opted to create some financial flexibility, which has given them cap room, which is not something that has been associated with the Wizards probably since 2016, when they went into free agency and tried to get Kevin Durant, and then, of course, Al Horford, and struck out and
right.
ended up signing Jan Mahimi. But cap room is something they haven't had in a long
Don't
time.
Don't remind me. $64 million. Right. Don't remind me of that.
So there's no question that right now – the toolbox, there's plenty of options for Tommy Shepard. It's kind of up to what he does with them now.
All right. I do think it's interesting that you, in your two steps forward, considered a complete rebuild as a possibility, because that would mean also dealing Beal. Everything that I read last night sort of indicated that that's not what they're going to do, that Beal has every intention of staying and they have every intention of keeping him. So which is your lean? A total rebuild, which would mean, you know, clearing Beal off the deck too, or building around Beal?
My guess is that they'll build around Beal. I mean, just look at their track record, how no matter what has gone on, they've been committed to him. And
yeah.
Tommy Shepard said it, you know, pretty clearly the other day that as soon as the Wizards can offer an extension, that extension will be on the table ready for him to sign it if he wants it. So they're gonna do everything they can, I think, to build moving forward with him. But what is interesting is, you know, when Bradley Beal was mulling his future, and that whole thing was absolutely serious. It may have been downplayed by some and all that, and right now it looks like Bradley Beal is continuing to be committed to this team. But he was definitely considering his options. And one thing I was told by someone close to him is that he kind of feared getting back to square one, where he's the only star on a team and it's just him and a bunch of guys. Which is basically what it was when John Wall was recovering from injuries, right? They traded John Wall for Russell Westbrook. All of a sudden, Bradley Beal had another star and someone who could take on the scoring responsibility on any given night and go off for 25, 30 points and, you know, take some pressure off of him. So I do wonder how Bradley Beal will feel about this roster when it's all said and done. But you know, he remains committed, and ultimately it's got to be reminded, I think, anytime this comes up, that they can pay him a ton of money. If he waits until next offseason, he can make, like, it's something like 5 years, $266 million, would be the biggest contract in NBA history, the types of which, you know, you would pay to the very, very top player in the league.
So you believed the reports last week, which were, there were some out there that were contradicting the original reports, was that he was mulling his future and considering asking for a trade. You believe that he was actually, yes, mulling his future and considering asking for a trade?
No question. Yeah, I think he was. I think just comparing it to rumors of the past, this was definitely more serious and definitely the highest likelihood that he was going to be out. Now, I checked in and I confirmed all this stuff and got details. And what I reminded everyone in that story is that, you know, just look at their past and look at the past of Tommy Shepard. He's done a good job of quieting the noise in the past. No one thought he would get the contract extension signed with Beal in 2019. So I wouldn't bet against him being able to do it again. And right now it looks like momentum is moving in Tommy Shepard's favor. In that regard, that it seems like he's got Bradley Beal on board, just like he has been in the past, despite at least a brief period of him considering his options.
So let's consider this for a moment, because I think you sort of laid out the way Beal felt when he was the only guy out there. And so he wants more, and maybe the relationship is such in which they're promising him more. But do you think that perhaps getting rid of Westbrook and dealing him to L.A. was a good thing for keeping Beal?
Well, I think it could be. I think the flexibility that they've given themselves does allow for the potential to build a roster with a higher ceiling. I think when you have two players who are making up essentially 70% of the salary cap, and one of them in Russell Westbrook is making $45 million, then it's just so hard to build a roster around them if those guys aren't, you know, LeBron James and Anthony Davis, or one of them isn't Giannis Antetokounmpo, because you just look at their payroll last year, and there's a huge drop-off to the third guy, which was Davis Bertans, who obviously we could quibble with whether he's worth that money, and then you just don't have much room left for NBA-caliber rotation players that aren't on rookie contracts. You can't really have very many veterans in there. So you get Russell Westbrook out of there for $44, $45 million, and, you know, say you can replace him with a bunch of guys that are worth the same amount of money but give you three or four rotation players, then certainly it could help their ability to contend. But I think they're going to have to sell Bradley Beal on what the specific plan is right now, because, like I said, you look at this roster right now and it's a little difficult to deduce.
Yeah, I want to get to sort of the weirdly shaped roster, you know, off of these trades yesterday, but that's not why I asked you necessarily about Westbrook in terms of Beal. I was wondering whether or not it was more than just, okay, we freed up all of this space. Not all stars are, you know, the same, you know, to play with. I'm just wondering if you have a thought on whether or not, you know, after a season, and it was exciting at times, certainly in the regular season, that maybe Beal, who's pretty intelligent, also came to the conclusion that this isn't the combo that contends.
Well, when it comes to contending, I'm not sure, but I do believe that, and you know, I talked to Brad about the impact Russ had on him, and he thought he was a great teammate. I think you kind of see this happen with Russell Westbrook. A lot of his teammates love playing with him. His coaches love coaching him, and I think Bradley Beal just appreciated, as a lot of other guys have in the past, just the consistent effort and competitive fire that Russell Westbrook brings. You know, Paul George said before this past season that he had the best year of his career in Oklahoma City because of Russell Westbrook, because that mindset and that 110% effort every play really rubbed off on him. And Bradley Beal saw a similar effect this year. So I think he liked playing with Russ. Whether he thought he could contend with him, I'm not sure, but maybe the conversation from the Wizards could be, look, even if you liked playing with him, this is for the best, your best interest and the best interest of the team.
All right, let's talk about the trades. Westbrook to L.A. for Kuzma, KCP, and Harrell, and then that number 22 pick, which they then turned into Aaron Holiday and the 31st overall pick. First of all, on the trade itself, what did you think on Kuzma, you know, Caldwell Pope, Harrell, and the first round pick? And I know the Wizards also are giving up some future second rounders to the Lakers. What did you think of the deal?
Well, I think it has to be tied to the beginning of this whole transaction, which would be trading away John Wall. And if you just consider the fact that they got the first round pick back, it sort of kind of cancels out the one that they had to attach to John Wall. And you took a contract, a supermax contract, with a guy who was on a ruptured Achilles, and got three rotation players in return, essentially. And in Russell Westbrook, you get out from under his supermax contract. Obviously, not as debilitating because he doesn't have the injury history, but just an impressive feat in that regard. I think that needs to be mentioned. And then they got three good players back. You know, Kyle Kuzma, obviously, and the spotlight of LA, drew a lot of criticism. His numbers have been down, but he's a talented young player who's proven to be a pretty good shooter in the past. Caldwell Pope is a pretty scrappy defender, can also shoot the three, ideal in a bench role, I would say. And I've always been a big fan of Montrezl Harrell. I like the effort he brings. He's a good rebounder, extremely efficient around the rim. So that, I think they have a lot more depth now. They've got more versatility. They've got more shooting, and that's a good thing. Now, with the subsequent trade, trading that 22nd pick, I thought was a little interesting. I thought maybe they could stay there and get another first-round talent. But clearly they liked what Aaron Holiday can bring in terms of his defensive potential, and he's a pretty good shooter as well.
Yeah, I'm a big Harrell fan as well. I didn't like him off of the Clippers this year. I think they could have used him. I personally, we haven't talked probably since the NBA Finals were over. It was a phenomenal run for Milwaukee. It was great for the city. It was great for Giannis. Giannis is incredible. I don't think there's any chance they get by Brooklyn if Brooklyn doesn't have those injuries. And I think if Kawhi doesn't go down, the Clippers would have won the title. But that's beside the point. Yeah, they get back Aaron Holiday, and then they end up taking a player at 31 overall. So let's look at the roster now, because it is an odd roster. There's really no starting point guard on this team. You know, a team that added a lot of shooters with Corey Kispert being drafted at 15. By the way, I like Kispert. I always liked Kispert. By the way, he's competitive and is an incredible shooter. But if you watch the title game, like most of you did, he was manhandled by men. Just understand that Baylor, that was men versus boys in that title game. And you can talk all about how Gonzaga was tired after that multi-overtime game thriller against UCLA. That was men versus boys in that game. But they added, Chase, a lot of shooting to this roster, some defense to this roster, some competitiveness to the roster, which they obviously had with Westbrook. But how does this roster move forward, you know, as it is? There's more coming, isn't there?
Well, they have to find a point guard, as you mentioned. They've got the mid-level exception, and, you know, maybe you could fit like a Lonzo Ball or a Spencer Dinwiddie or a Derrick Rose, that level of a point guard in there. But then you've got just some really interesting problems to solve in terms of putting these lineups together, because they have shooting, but they've also got some forwards and big men that you wonder how well they could play together. You know, Montrezl Harrell, Daniel Gafford, Rui Hachimura, Denny Avdija. You've kind of got this nucleus of forwards and big men that can't really shoot from the outside, but then you have guys who can offset that. So I think it's an interesting roster. Thomas Bryant will be coming back from an ACL injury. He's a really good shooter. Davis Bertans is a really good shooter. You add Kispert to that equation. Maybe with more space, Bradley Beal can shoot better. He shot a career low 3-point percentage this past season. So I think they've got a lot more options. Defense and shooting could be strengths when those were relative weaknesses last year. Obviously, they fixed their defense on the fly, but the 3-point shooting was never there. So I think the fact that they have more shooters, if I had one takeaway, that would be the good thing, because they had to work around not being able to make threes last year, and that's just not ideal in this day and age.
I just think to take advantage of these shooters, they've got to have a point guard. You know, I mean, what have we had since 2009? That was the year John was drafted, right? 2011. What year was
2010?
2010. Thank you.
They've had a
high assist point guard for a long period of time. They don't have one right now, and I just think with all of those shooters, if Beal is your primary creator out of the offense, you may not be able to take advantage of that. So, what are their options point guard wise?
Well, first of all, that's a good point to make, that they haven't had to search for a point guard in a long time, not since 2010, because you have John Wall and Russell Westbrook. Obviously, Wall was hurt sometimes, but you thought he was coming back. Kind of reminds me of the Washington football team when they had, and this is not a perfect comparison, but Chris Samuel and then Trent Williams.
Right.
And then once they needed a left tackle, it was just like an unusual feeling. So, they need a point guard, first time in a long time. I would expect them to explore trades for that, but you're probably looking at someone who would fit into the mid-level exception, which is about going to be about $9.5 million per year. You can give them a multi-year deal. So I think Derrick Rose, Patty Mills, maybe Spencer Dinwiddie, who also tore his ACL last season. And Lonzo Ball would be a question for me because, you know, I know a lot of teams are going to be interested in him, and I don't know if you could fit him into the mid-level exception because he is young and presents upside. But if you have a lineup of shooters and Lonzo Ball to distribute it, I like that. I mean, he's a really good rebounder, a really good passer, and he's become a much better shooter over the years than I think a lot of people realize because he's been hasn't been playing for a marquee team. But he's turned into a pretty good shooter despite all the, obviously that was made of him coming out of college and his shooting form and all that. So I think he would make sense if the Wizards could get him.
Is any of this in your mind leading to a potential Ben Simmons trade?
I don't see how they could acquire a player like Ben Simmons at this point. You know, the first round pick, making that pick with Corey Kispert, takes away the hypothetical appeal of that as an asset. You know, that eliminates one thing. And just the asking price sounds like it's so high in Philadelphia. I mean, there's reports that they want, you know, players and multiple first round picks and pick swaps. So I think the price is going to have to come down for them to trade Ben Simmons to anyone. But I would expect right now that it'd be really difficult for the Wizards to pull off a trade that would bring in a guy of that caliber. I mean, he might be the best option via trade available all summer. And so there's going to be a lot of competition. And I think it would be difficult, especially when you consider the Wizards have their first-round picks tied up a little bit with that John Wall trade.
Yeah, I think that price is going to come down. There are no takers for that player at that price right now. All right. You mentioned Dinwiddie. There have been some reports that is a player they're going to target. Dinwiddie coming off that ACL injury in Brooklyn. I think personally Reggie Jackson's going to get a huge contract off of the way he played in the postseason for the Clippers. I've loved Jackson for a while now. I was glad to see him get into that spot and really excel. And he's not necessarily, you know, he's a scoring point guard and so is Dinwiddie, by the way. And really the point guards that are out there, with the exception of like Chris Paul or maybe Conley, are all scoring point guards, right? For the most part, you'd be adding, you know, a scoring point guard. But that's got to be the move. Like, that's got to be the next, you know, domino to fall. You're not going to go into this season with Aaron Holiday as your starting point guard, are you?
No, I don't think so. Dinwiddie with the ACL is interesting. I mean, I liked him as a player before the injury, but he only played 3 games last year. Got injured, of course, and you'd be having him and Thomas Bryant coming back from the same injury, and Thomas Bryant's not going to be ready to start the season. So you're talking about two pretty important rotation players that would be affected by a serious injury. So that's got to be noted. But in the whole conversation about a point guard and them sort of relying on elite point guards for a long time, I don't think it's the worst thing to transition away from that. You know, the Wizards over the past decade plus have really been committed to building a team around the backcourt. And just historically, not very many great NBA teams, NBA championship teams, have been built that way. I think a lot of people obviously look at the Warriors with Steph Curry and Klay Thompson. But if you look at the history of the game, that's a major aberration. You probably have to go back to the Pistons with Isaiah Thomas and Joe Dumars to find the previous example. You're much better off having a more balanced roster. If you have a second star and one of your stars is a guard, you're better off if that guy's a wing or a big. So if the Wizards end up going into a new era where they don't have a star point guard, but they're able to find a star somewhere else, I honestly think that would be for the best.
Yeah, it's funny as you say that. I mean, obviously we all think of Golden State, but even Cleveland, we can call LeBron whatever he was, but he and Kyrie Irving were the two primary ball handlers, you know, offensively. Even though they had different assignments defensively. I look at this roster and it just doesn't make a lot of sense right now. So I'm with you. I think something's going to happen. But, you know, netting it all out, Chase, like they were a playoff team. If they hadn't had COVID, if Westbrook hadn't been hurt early, you know, maybe it was in a normal 82-game schedule, a roster capable of winning, you know, 44, 45, 46 games, being a 5 seed. But, you know, maybe winning one playoff series, maybe. That was, I think that was the max. And now you've got a roster right now as it exists that would struggle to make the playoffs next year in the Eastern Conference. Do you agree with that?
I agree. I think as constituted, they're not a playoff team. Now, of course, they'll get a point guard, so that'll change some things. But, yeah, I mean, just look at the teams in the Eastern Conference. I mean, the Celtics. Look at the Celtics or the team that the Wizards played in the play-in tournament. Is this team going to beat the Celtics or have a better record? You know, Miami Heat. I think the Hornets are on the rise. So that bottom part of the Eastern Conference is getting better. And then, of course, the gap, as we saw when the Wizards played the Sixers, was pretty wide. And the Sixers weren't even the best team in the East. I mean, Milwaukee was better. Brooklyn was better. So, yeah, I think the Wizards, right now, I would probably put them as the you know, somewhere in like the 8 to 10 range in the East.
Yeah, I mean, right now, the starting lineup, if they had to play a game tomorrow, and let's just assume that they do add a point guard, and then we don't know who they would lose for that point guard, but, you know, it's Beal, it's Hachimura, it should be Gafford, in my opinion, with Harrell sort of backing him up, because I'd love Harrell back in that sixth man role. And then, you know, probably Kuzma, right? And the new point guard, whomever that is.
That would be, I think, a safe guess. Denny Avdia maybe could play his way into that three spot, but Kuzma's at this point a better player, more accomplished, so I think he would be the starter, and that would be the starting lineup I would roll out at this point as well.
I know you had a long night. I appreciate you making time for me this morning. We'll talk soon. Thanks, Chase.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Chase Hughes at Chase Hughes NBCS. Thanks to Chase. Thanks to Mark Zuckerman. Have a great weekend, everybody. I am taking Monday off. We will be in the midst of a move, but we'll be back on Tuesday and the rest of next week. Have a great weekend.